You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti, the lively, the glamorous, the erudite, the... I'm trying to think of adjectives here. Help me out.
I like it. I was just going to let you keep going. I was going to bask in all of this. This is awesome.
Tall. I don't know if you're tall or not, but
I'm just... terribly short. I am tall for a hobbit. Yeah.
Okay. The stubby... See, stubby is not nearly good as good as
No, tall. I'm tall for a hobbit. That's how I go with it.
Okay. All right. The taller than a hobbit. Sherry Antonetti. Yes. And we are here on the last day before election 2016 America.
You had to bring that up. No.
I think I'm going to call it election 2016. Kronk, pull the lever.
Wrong lever. Actually, I was going to say the first thing. Yes. Oh, it's perfect. Oh, I was going to just say the first rule of election 2016. We do not talk about the election of 2016.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to talk about it today because, I want to have a little conversation today about, the phenomenon, which is ever with us in the church, of heresy, because heresy is something that's always a temptation, and it's not a temptation because heresy is about people lying. Heresy is about people fixating on a truth.
And seeing any other truth except that truth.
Turn it into the only truth there is. And the thing is that because it really is about a truth, the bigger and more important that truth is, the easier it is to turn it into a heresy.
That is a sad thing. It is true.
It's super easy because if you get fixated on some trivial truth, someone will laugh at you and go, "This, you know, it's just not all that important." You know, yes, it's true that you should drive the correct speed limit, but you know, if for some reason somebody is in the backseat of your car having a baby, and you're exceeding the speed limit because you really got to get there, people can look at that and go, "That's understandable. You know, the law is made for man, not man for the law." Or in this case, woman.
You're engaging in situational ethics. I'm just horrified. Oh my God, I'm gonna have vapors.
It's nonetheless, as Jesus said, the law is made for man, not man for the law. And so sometimes look at less laws and say they have to give way to greater laws. And that's all true.
Matters. Judgment matters. Okay,
Just exercise some prudence here. So the thing is that when we start talking about like really big, important things, it gets harder and harder to see that as big and important as that thing is, it's not all there is. And the great paradigm of this has already happened in the life of the church. It happened in the fourth century.
Arianism.
Nothing could be more important than the glory of God in the church's teaching, right? This is it. This is everything that it's about, you know, and everything goes down before it, including, for example, the great good of human life. So why did the martyrs sacrifice their lives? They sacrificed their lives because the glory of God was more important than their life.
Right.
And so in the early church, a guy named Arius comes along and says, nothing is more important than the glory of God the Father. Nothing is more important than the glory of God the Father. And you know what?
St. Nicholas punched him in the face, I think.
Well, actually, you'll get an argument from Rod Bennett about that. But
okay. Well, it's a great story.
True, even if it isn't. But and there's all kinds of biblical reasons for that. You know, Jesus himself says the Father is greater than I. Nothing yes. can be more important than the glory of God the Father. And therefore. Jesus is not God, which says Arius.
Wrong. Okay.
Yeah, right. But the thing is that Arius could always say to any critic, I mean, this is the outstanding, situation of his position, and this is why it was such a big deal and such a problem for the church,
right?
Because Arius could always say, "Are you telling me that something is more important than the glory of God the Father?"
You're like stuck. It is the religious equivalent of when did you stop beating your wife?
Right. And so Arius comes along and he says something that sounds to his partisans, of course, like, you know, this is everything we're about as Christians, is the glory of God. But he says that Jesus is not God. He's merely God's greatest creature. And so, you should honor Jesus and all the rest of it, but he is not big G God. He is more like a godlet. He's sort of like a super archangel, God's greatest creature. He was the first creature that God made and all the rest of it. And this threatens to destroy the church.
Yeah, because
fourth century. Because Jesus
sounds reasonable.
It sounds reasonable, and it sounds like anybody asserting the orthodox position is watering down the truth.
They're not thinking like the rest of us.
They're not thinking. Yeah, they're watering down the truth, and they're taking glory away from God by giving it to Jesus. And so they have to be stopped. And this is a huge crisis that strikes the early church. It threatens to tear apart the church. It's tearing apart the Roman dominions, which have, you know, are now largely Christian. And so it's Constantine, the emperor, who is himself not a Christian yet.
That's what makes it so awesome a story. I mean, really, truly does.
Who goes to the bishops and says, fix this.
I love it. Fix it.
Do something of it. Work it out. I don't care how you work it out, but work it out, you idiots, because you guys are tearing apart my dominions. And I don't know about the theology stuff, but I do know that I don't want a civil war in my realm. So fix it, right?
Right.
And that's where the Council of Nicaea comes from. And when the Council of Nicaea meets, what they do is they, in fact, look at the whole of the church's tradition, not just Arius's greatest hits. They're not just interested in the Bible verses that Arius thinks are super important. They're interested in all the Bible verses.
There you go. Everything. You have to do everything.
And so this is where the church finally arrives at, not at formulating something that they've never said before, but rather formulating something that they've always said before. And that's where we get the creed, that Jesus is God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made. That's the key phrase right there.
Right. More fully rendering what we always knew, essentially.
Always knew. And this is all, you know, so it's John that calls Jesus the only begotten Son of God. So they're not making up language here. And the point that they're making when they say begotten, not made, is exactly that Jesus is not a creature. If I make a statue that looks like me, I've made something. If I have a son who looks like me, I've begotten something.
Yes.
And the difference is that what is begotten shares in the nature of the begetter. What's the nature of God? God is God. God. Yes. What is the nature of God the Son?
God.
The nature of the Son is God.
yes.
And so not
sees me, sees the Father. It's pretty straightforward.
Exactly. And so when we're looking at heresy, we're never looking at something that is simply a lie. We're always looking at something that is an inflamed and swollen truth. It's a truth that has started to block out all the rest of the church's truth.
A truth that's become an idol.
Right. And I say all that in preface to...
Winding up, yes.
That is really important for us to discuss. I think in the church, particularly in the American church, in this day and hour, because it is my contention, not that the whole thing is, but that significant portions of the pro-life movement have become a heresy.
That's hard to say. You're going to lose a lot of friends there.
It's a painful thing to say, but what we're talking about, again, is something that the church herself teaches, but is now being used in ways to attack the rest of the church's teaching.
Right.
And we saw a spectacular
example of
that today, or yesterday, actually. Father Frank Pavone, who has done some very important work for the pro-life movement.
Very well known,
head of Priests for Life. He took the naked corpse of an aborted baby and he placed it on an altar. Get out the vote, Donald Trump.
I want to talk about this next.
We'll come back to this.
It's insane connecting God's postmark shame and.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello! Connecting the Dots. I'm host Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. So before we went to the break, I started to describe what happened yesterday. I still find it hard to believe. But Father Frank Bone, who's the head of Priests for Life, took the corpse of an unborn baby that had been entrusted to him for burial.
Yes.
And he took it naked, laid it on an altar on live streaming video, and then proceeded to deliver himself of a 44-minute rant, which was all ramping up to, in essence, vote Donald Trump or the baby gets it. It was heartbreaking. So wrong at so many levels.
It's heartbreaking.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, the analogy that I used in trying to describe this was sacrilege. There's no other word for it.
Yeah, you're not supposed to place anything on the altar except that which will be used in the celebration of the Eucharist.
Right.
And that does not include the body of an unborn child.
Or any human being. I mean, my illustration that I tried to use to describe just the violence that was done here.
Yes.
Was, you know, imagine some priest who is gung-ho about gun control, presiding over the funeral of President Kennedy and placing his naked dead body on the altar, you know, with his brains exposed and saying, you know, I'm just here. I'm just trying to, you know, I'm undergirding the church's teaching about, you know, the sanctity of human life. Who in their right mind would look at that?
When you receive caring for the dead is a corporal act of mercy.
Right.
And we're supposed to imitate the Blessed Mother in terms of how we reference the dead. She didn't take the crucifix with her son on it and march around complaining to the Romans about they should get rid of the death penalty.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You know,
she wrapped her son in robes and anointed him to place him in a burial ground. It was a last farewell. It was tender. It was intimate, and it was reverent.
Right.
And this is
because, not- and this is, I mean, this is the real irony here, of course, of what has now become again. Not there are, believe you me, and I have been hearing from them all day today, there are plenty of pro-life Catholics and Protestants who are recoiling in horror from this because they're actually pro-life. I mean, and they care about the dignity of the human person. The irony of this is that the entirety of the Catholic pro-life position is about the dignity of the human person.
The unborn, yes.
Of the unborn. And what has happened? The unborn has become a prop.
Well, it's a shocking, it's a sad parody of, you know, Dr. Gosnell had babies in jars on his table where he worked.
Right.
And you know, you can't use a person or a person's body and not be committing a sin. You're using them. You're treating them like like a thing,
right,
as opposed to a person.
Right. And it's so this has been very rightly, I think, described as abortion porn. That's what it was. Yeah. It was the objectification. And why? For what? For what purpose?
Shock.
For shock and to get you to go vote for this guy who does not care at all about this baby, who has refused to answer the question of whether he has personally paid for abortions himself, who is a sex predator, you know, multiple adulterer, somebody who has called on us to make use of torture, to murder civilians, to murder women and children.
This was not right. Well, I'm going to focus on the baby, honestly. You can't, you know, I don't care who you're voting for. You don't do this to a baby. You don't do this to the body of a baby.
Right.
You don't do this to an altar. You don't do this to score a political point. You don't do this to advocate for a cause. You just don't. The baby should be wrapped and laid in a tomb. This is hurtful to every woman who's ever lost a child,
right?
Who's ever, you know, whoever suffers from post-traumatic stress syndrome because they had an abortion. This, and to the mother who aborted the child, this is painful beyond recognition.
Right.
And he had no right.
Right. It was a desperately wrong thing to do. And it was done, of course, as these things always are.
For good intentions.
Well, the ends justify the means, right?
Yes, that's it.
You know, that's the idea behind it is, you know, we're going to have to just cut some corners here because the ends are so important. And in this case, the end is, you know, vote Trump or the baby gets it. But it can be any end that you happen to think is a good one.
Anytime, yes. It's just
the irony of this, of course, and this is always the case, by the way. One of the ironies of heresy. Remember, heresy is not a lie. Heresy is when you take one truth out of the whole deposit of faith, and then it let it become swollen and inflamed like a boil, until it threatens the health of the rest of the church's teaching.
Unless you have 10 children, you're not a Catholic mom. Doesn't work. Yeah, it's that's crazy talk.
It can be any truth, and in this case, of course, the truth is a very hugely important one. The dignity of human life from conception to natural death. It's a hugely important truth. And because it's so hugely important, it becomes very difficult for people who are blinded by that one truth to see that it can't be and must not be the only truth. And when you start using that as a weapon against the rest of what the church has to say, so, for example, using it as a weapon against what the church has to say about treatment of
Syrian refugees,
refugees, you name it. Yeah, I mean, everything that Trump stands for. Sure, we're, you know, yes, torture is an unfortunate thing, but abortion is even more important. You know, when we start talking this way, one of the weird things that happens with heresies is that heresy, if you give it enough time, will tend to start to mutate into its opposite. So getting back to Arianism, for example, Arianism started, and it's you know, there have been resurgent forms of Arianism that have happened throughout the life of the church. So the Puritans, many of the Puritans who came to the New World were themselves ardent Calvinists whose concern for the glory of God became so intense that they became Unitarians. Unitarians are people, are basically a resurgent form of Arianism initially. So the all that matters is the glory of God, and we can forget about the deity of Jesus. That's not as important. Well, the irony, of course, is that the Unitarianism of the 16th and 17th century eventually became the atheism.
Oh, geez.
The 19th centuries, right? We can get rid of all of that, right? And this is one of those things that happens, and we're watching this happen now.
Well, once you divide a piece of Christ's cloak, the rest of it falls to pieces.
That's dangerous. That's one of those seamless garment things. Yes. You're a liberal. You need to be silenced. But
gosh, I've never been called a liberal in my entire life.
you get it a lot now if you question Donald Trump and if you question the wisdom, for example, of what Father Pavone did today. You clearly are in favor of abortion. You can tell that by your 10 kids.
And the one with Down syndrome in particular, yes.
Yes, yes. Clearly in favor of abortion. But that's the weird thing about this, is we're now seeing the leadership of a movement that used to talk about the dignity of the human person from conception to natural death. And now what's it doing? It's
not
It's using the unborn like a prop for a political ad.
It can't. Yeah. You know, and I want to say, though, I mean, this hurts so many people. That's my deep pain about this, is because I am someone who loves being pro-life, and it's so hard to go gently with those who disagree, because in many cases, part of why they disagree is I either know somebody who's committed an abortion or they themselves have had one.
Right.
And it's such a deep scar. It's such a deep wound. You will never win those hearts by using a bludgeon. And the whole goal is to win their heart.
Right. Yeah. So I all of that is to say, well, you know, you wouldn't think at first. I think a lot of people wouldn't, for example, connect something like the Arian heresy with what happened yesterday with
Father Pavone's act. Yeah.
But it's the same dynamic going on where you take a single truth and you blow it up until you're starting to attack the rest of the church's teaching, and it's a crazy thing to do. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here with Sherry Antonetti talking about heresy, and we'll be back on Redbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Hello! Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, and we are here with Sheraton Eddie.
Hello, hello.
We're talking about the just the incredible weirdness of this election year, and the spectacle of how. You know, I get it. I really do. I have been pro-life all my life, and it is frustrating to see, a culture that isn't budging on this.
It seems to almost trumpet abortion and being pro-death. I mean, it really does seem to. It doesn't really, but it feels that way sometimes. Like you're the only one in the room. It does feel that way if you're pro-life.
Yeah.
Like you're almost a secret. You have to give like a secret handshake to admit, come out of the closet that you're pro-life.
Well, on the other hand, though, I think somebody once pointed out to me, I've got a friend who's a historian, and he said that one of the ironies of the Reformation was that the Reformation was in part a function of the church's success, not the church's failure, because what you had in the Reformation was a laity that was getting to understand its faith better than it ever had. And when that happens, one of the things that takes place is you start to see how far you have to go still.
Yes.
And how much isn't going well, and so people can get upset and frustrated, and in no small part, you know, that was part of what happened with the Reformation, was that you had people who got a grasp of their faith enough to realize how far the faith had to go, and there was real corruption in the church and all the rest of it, but in the same way, you know, I mean, we've had. What we forget in the United States is that we've got a pro-life movement that's kind of the envy of the rest of the world. It's robust and it's loud and, you know.
It's young.
And so you get that, but you also, of course, you're still confronted with a culture where, you know, the paradox of American culture is that everybody on both sides of the abortion debate can claim that most Americans are with them. If you're part of the 20% of Americans who want abortion outlawed, you can point to the fact that the other 60%, another 60% of American culture also doesn't like abortion.
Yes.
Show that repeatedly. But if you're on the 20% of the bell curve that does not want to outlaw Roe v. Wade, you can point to that same 60%
and say they don't want it outlawed.
You don't want to outlaw Roe v. Wade either, right? And so everybody on both sides can say, you know, the pro-life people can say 80% of the American people don't like abortion, and that is absolutely true.
And 80% don't want it outlawed.
80% do not want it outlawed.
Also true,
you know. And the thing is that both political parties know that perfectly well. And so, you know, one of them plays to one end of the base, but then says, as Clinton said for years, well, we want abortion safe, legal, and rare, which is exactly what Americans want.
Yes.
They want it legal, and they don't like it, and they don't want to ever have to think about it ever again.
Yeah,
right?
please don't bring it up.
And so there's that, there's also the people who really don't like it, and they always say, we'd really rather not have it around. We don't want to think about it. This is exactly the problem that the United States faced during the Civil War, before the Civil War.
Yeah, don't want slavery.
We don't want to think about it, and we don't want to do anything about it either. You know.
Yeah, we have a tough time. You know, the great being able to have, as long as we don't have to deal with it, we're good. We'll just get
And so, the great weapon that the pro-life movement has had for 40 years, we've had this, has been the power of moral suasion. That is how we have won repeatedly. not in the legal sphere, but in the moral sphere. We have saved so many lives through the integrity of our witness, not because we had
better finance or better organizing.
The state behind us, you know, telling people what to do. We have saved millions of lives that way. And what we are doing now in backing a man like Donald Trump and in pulling stunts like this appalling use of a dead baby on an altar is we're throwing away our power of moral suasion in this Faustian bargain, this hope that somehow if we just have political clout, then we could win this. It is suicide.
I got to say that people have been told for decades, if we just get the right candidate, we will get the right Supreme Court. If we get the right Supreme Court, we will make this all go away.
Right.
And they have been told that since I was in high school.
I've heard all my life. And it's a lie. And it has always been a lie.
But people don't want to think that's a lie.
I know, because it's heartbreaking to realize, you know, what goes with this is a conception of America, you know, the light and the glory, a royal priesthood, a chosen nation, a holy people, consecrated.
A city on the hill.
A city on a hill. This is a deeply American myth that conservatives and therefore conservative Christians have drunk in. For decades, they've drunk this in, and Catholics have foolishly drunk this in. And Catholics should know better. I mean, we came to this country primarily as immigrants, and we were treated like garbage for 100 years. We forget, you know, that it was a big deal 60 years ago that JFK was a Catholic.
Well, I mean, like the basilica that's in Baltimore was fashioned so you couldn't tell from the harbor that it was a Catholic church.
Really?
So that it wouldn't get burnt. Yeah, I toured it, and that was one of the little bits of tidbits that was a deliberate decision. You wanted to make it look not like a Catholic church that you would recognize over in Europe, so that it wouldn't get burnt.
Yeah. Okay. So this myth that America is a deeply is somehow going to live out the Christian dream. It's not really real. You know, it's Protestant to its bones. And it's certainly there's always been this messianic stream that runs through America's talk about itself. We've always talked this way about
and ourselves. A utopian vision of itself that if we from Hawthorne to now, if we just tweak policy one way or the other, we will have everything perfect.
By an alabaster city's gleam undimmed by human tears. Yes. Yeah. And that, you know, that and that's really that's part of our DNA. This is one of the things that Chesterton noted 100 years ago when he came to the U.S. He described America very profoundly, I think, and very perceptively. He said America is a nation with the soul of a church, that we really do. We have preserved this kind of Calvinist vision of the city on the hill, and this, you know, we have this messianic picture of ourselves, and we've talked. It's been part of our political discourse forever. Right from the beginning. Oh yeah, you know, you can go to the Capitol. You can see the apotheosis of George Washington as he's being assumed into heaven. Right. Yes. I mean, this is all over the place. We stand at Armageddon, said Roosevelt over some. Yeah. Trivial, you know, economic reform policy. We stand at Armageddon, he said, and we battle for the Lord. This is all over the place. We talk this way. When Clinton is inaugurated, he talks about a new covenant with the American people. And, you know, a decade ago, Bush is talking and he's saying, I remember the speech. I remember listening to it on the radio and thinking, this is so classic. He says, there's power, power, wonder-working power in, you know, the American people.
Yes, yes.
Used to be the precious blood of the lamb, right? But not anymore.
Not yet. Yeah.
So we do this all the time. We've always done this. We saw this. We saw this with Obama's campaign. There was tons of messianic rhetoric about that guy.
I thought they ran out of purple prose at one pen ends at one point of all the prose that they referenced. So, I mean,
yeah. And so that belief is also there with the pro-life movement, and it's been very, very difficult for the pro-life movement to really face the fact that no, you are not going to overturn Roe v. Wade, that the majority of your countrymen don't want to overturn Roe v. Wade, and that neither candidate has the slightest interest in overturning Roe v. Wade. And most of all, and this is the thing that people cannot face, Roe v. Wade is the product of Republican justices. It is the creation of Republican appointees to the Supreme Court, and it has been maintained by Republican support appointees to the Supreme Court. We will talk about this when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti, and we will be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Sherry Antonetti.
Hello.
Yeah. So, you know, as we look at, you know, how do we get here? You know, I that's the thing is, you know, you just keep thinking, okay, we're now at a place where a Catholic priest and respected pro-life leader is using dead babies is desecrating an altar.
Well, I'd say that, remember that we shouldn't be shocked by sin. It's a scandal to be shocked by sin.
Well, yeah.
And so that somebody falls far afield, you know, that should not shock us.
No. It's just, how do we stop this? You were mentioning over the break, apparently the Bishop of Amarillo has now, I haven't
not looked, publicly, but
not public, but is making apologies at least on the phone or something.
Yes. In response to the responses that are flooding the office at the moment.
Okay. Well, that's good. I mean, I'm hoping that he's going to make a public statement.
Me too.
Because this is a public scandal. It's something that needs to be addressed publicly.
Yes, but I think probably first they're going to go and address it like a brother in Christ and say, hey, that would to me be the pastoral reproach to it, because he's got to try to bring the priest back to where he needs to be. And that would probably be the first step.
Yeah.
I did read that a friend who contacted the Archdiocese of Amarillo, that's what's coming out of their office, that they are apologizing and they know about it and they're figuring out how to address it properly.
Yeah, well, they were apologizing. I mean, there was a lady on the phone. I called them today and said, you know, yikes. And she was full of apologies and not at all happy.
It's a hard day for her.
Oh, I'm sure it is. Yeah. Especially, you know, because Amarillo isn't like, it's a fairly small diocese.
Right,
you know,
right.
Population, and all of a sudden it's become ground zero for, you know, these poor guys, you know.
It's not something they expect to see in their everyday.
That's the thing. It's just, you know, I was talking to somebody, and they had contacted a canon lawyer that they knew about this, and the canon lawyer was basically saying, "You've ever heard the phrase, 'It's so far off, it's not even wrong.'" You ever heard that expression?
What?
And the canon lawyer was basically saying, we don't have anything in canon law to deal with this situation because it's like
this
so
is new. This is no one thought of this before.
Nobody ever thought of this before. Who would do something this crazy? You know. So I'm sure that that's part of what's going on right now too. It's just the canon lawyers are all kind of scratching their heads and going, "Well, I don't know. I never imagined that anybody would do this." You know.
I will tell you that it's so easy though to get whipped up with zealotry when you know your cause is just. And I know because that's what happens is that because, you know, St. Paul, you can speak to this quite personally, you know, his cause was just. He was preserving Jewish faith, you know, right, from these heretics.
Yeah.
And
that's the thing is, you know, when you're smarter than the church, you know.
Yeah, which none of us are. Okay.
So, you know, and so that's what concerns me, because I know that tomorrow morning, you know, partly it'll be taken up with the election, but I also know from experience that what I'm going to see probably starting later this afternoon will be a flood of people talking about the Church of Nice persecuting a living saint because the church is not willing to tell the truth about abortion. Because, of course, nobody knew that the Catholic Church was opposed to abortion. That's a big secret, right?
Yeah, I don't think anyone's confused on that point. But I also, you know, no, it's not, you know, how can you, I'll take Church of Nice if it means we're not going to have dead children on our altar. Because that doesn't strike me as particularly Catholic. As a rule.
Yeah.
I still go back to that, you know, I want to hit him on that point that he was supposed to hold this child with the reverence that the father should have held this child and the mother should have held this child.
That child was entrusted for burial.
And he should have been weeping over this child's loss, not what was done. And that, I can't tell you how much that pains me. I only know that no one's ever been convinced about the wrongness of abortion by argument or by polemics. People are convinced of the wrongness of abortion because their heart is pierced.
Right.
And that doesn't happen because you're revulsed.
Right.
It doesn't happen because you're grossed out. And it doesn't happen when you show rage. It happens when you show love.
Right. And, you know, this has been my concern all along for the pro-life movement and for the witness of the church, that this kind of stuff has done in the last 3 months has done more damage to the pro-life movement than anything that Hillary Clinton could have done in the past 30 years.
I think people are afraid that if Hillary Clinton is elected, that the policies that currently exist, which promote abortion in that it funds it under the Obamacare, or which persecute religious liberty in the form of, you know, putting the Little Sisters of the Poor through legal process, is going to continue. And I think,
right, of course,
I think
will continue under Trump too.
Well, I think that's what they hope not. The reasoning goes is that they think they know it will continue under Hillary. They don't know for 100% certain, 100% that it'll happen under Trump. And that's the reasoning they give, because that's the reasoning I hear.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's absolutely the reasoning. Sure it is. The better the devil you don't know argument.
Why do we have this lever?
And of course that's the case. But, you know, my argument in reply is, again, goes back to, and this is, by the way, it's John Paul's argument too.
Okay.
Politics is downstream of culture.
Yes. Now
what matters first is culture. And we've managed in the last year, we have managed to perhaps not create. I think probably what we've done is expose the fact that our pro-life culture is really mostly anti-abortion, not pro-life.
I think the people who are in the rank and file would disagree with you strongly, because I think they feel very passionately that they are pro-life. I know
they think that.
And I think they would feel wounded to be accused of not being pro-life. I think.
And I hear that. But the thing is that there are about 14 million people who all mostly entirely describe themselves as pro-life, who are cheering for a guy who is transparently not pro-life, and they're not silent about. They are actively working to excuse and often defend the things that this guy says that are dead 180% against the teaching of the church on a whole bunch of different pro-life issues.
Let's go back to your initial point of heresy.
Right.
Okay. I think that still applies right here. That's exactly what this is. It's the same blindness.
Right. Exactly.
The same blindness that's on the other side, that because Hillary cares for the poor, that, you know, because Democratic policies favor the poor, that therefore you can get it.
Therefore, abortion is fine.
Yes.
Exactly.
The blindness is a case of that I can justify my vote and ignore this evil. Right. And what we really should have is that everyone who is has an R next to their vote should be working darn hard for the poor. And everyone who has a D and claims to be Catholic should be working darn hard for pro-life.
Yes.
And that's what really should be happening.
And they should be advocating. Yeah, they should be advocating. And this is all it comes back to. Just
be Catholic and everything will work.
Stop fighting the church. That's really all I've got to say is, you know, it's great. Go ahead and be as pro-life as you want to be. Just don't, in the course of being pro-life, say, I can overlook Trump's racism.
Yeah.
No,
I can lie for Jesus.
I can use this dead baby as a prop because I'm so pro-life. And that has become about 14 million people, and a huge percentage of those are Catholics. That has become the kind of functional, here's a $3 word for you, soteriology. Soteriology is that part of the Christian tradition that deals with the question, what must I do to be saved? How are we saved? Well, for a lot of people, the functional soteriology in the United States is opposition to abortion taketh away the sins of the world. All I have to do is be abortion. I can do anything else. You know, Trump wants to torture people. Good for him.
Yeah. You
know? And it's like, can't do that, right?
No, we don't get to eliminate any of the Beatitudes in order to gain heaven. That doesn't work.
I know that I'm going to, you know, today what I'm hearing are excuses. Tomorrow what I'm going to be hearing are defenses for what was done on that altar. Well, at any rate, we're out of time, but we will be back tomorrow, Election Day, also known as D-Day.
Go to Adoration, people. Pray.
Go to Adoration and pray. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We've been here today with Sherry Antonetti. Our producer was Annie Head. And we'll be back on Redbox Media tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.